Want to begin by acknowledging that when we gather, however we gather in this part of the world on Treaty 1 territory. These are the original lands of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation, and we gather gratefully in this space. I feel as though this morning's exploration is a very small bite of a very large topic. Maybe that's not that unusual. But which I could describe as the entanglement of religion and racism. Yeah, I know, tidy, eh? Tidy little bundle. Anyway, it feels too cynical to me to believe that as humans we make religions primarily in order to oppress others, and yet that is often the way they end up being used to do just that. And so I wanted to see if I could approach that question or that idea in a way that might help me and maybe others to see how that can happen, and if there's anything that we can do to address that in our own thinking, our own believing, our own acting. So here's my basic idea this morning. Believing that my story about the world is superior to your story about the world can seriously get in the way of healing the divides between us as human beings. And that sense of verticality, my story is better than your story, is a not unusual feature of religion and race, both. And so I wanted to just kind of probe that a little bit. I should say that not all stories work equally well for all people or at all times, nor should they. And I think that's a really important sort of grounding idea. This isn't about turning the world into monochromatic mush when it comes to how we see it and how we live in it, but it is about learning something crucial about both the shared nature and the limited nature of the stories that we may know, and even the stories that we prefer, including potentially our religious ones, which allow us to hold those stories with greater humility, with more capacity for self-examination and self-criticism, as well as enlarging our ability to receive critical input from sources other than the ones that we might feel the most at home with. I think probably most of us are aware of the fact that, you know, when we look for things online, the algorithms just keep directing us back to the things that are related to the thing we were already looking for. And so we can end up sort of inside of this algorithmic bubble of preference. And if we actually want to examine what we believe, we want to question it and we want to probe it, then we need to find ways to get outside of that. Now, I think that all of that can help us not only re-understand the stories that we're most familiar with, but it can also open us to outright changing those stories when that needs to happen. So to not regarding those stories as immutable in some way. I grew up being taught that all humans are created by God and hence are equals. At the most basic level, a human is a human is a human. The bearer of the image of Creator, the holder of an exceptional position in the created order, essentially the top of the food chain when it comes to value. As I've lived my life, though, I've seen that although I may have been taught to think of all humans as equal, and even to ground that way of thinking about humanity in a particular religious framework, it's just not that tidy. In the words of the pigs that control the government in Orwell's novel Animal Farm, some are more equal than others. We're not going to get lost in literary analysis here, I promise you, but I think it's worth a few moments to just touch on the idea of how equal in that novel morphs in small increments from all are equal to being a relative term, meaning that there are degrees of equal. And in the book, the way that that happens is kind of by this subtle downgrading of the idea that all are equal to one another, which is how the idea is originally stated in the Seven Commandments in that novel. It sort of subtly downgrades from all are equal to one another to, which is, again, has this sort of specificity about it, to this really general idea that all are equal, period. And it's interesting and relevant that the word all is still part of the phrase, and that can be quite misleading. In the same way that if we don't handle it with real deliberateness and care, an idea like all lives matter can be a problem. And so the word all is retained in that phrase, but by the end of the novel, the word all is only there to differentiate some from all. It's only there to specify the uniqueness, the elite nature, the chosen status of the some that are more equal than the others. So that's important in terms of how we use language to talk about big ideas. Now, I grew up as an elite, culturally speaking. I grew up as one of the some. In that phrase, I'm white, middle class. I grew up in a world where I could be educated to pretty much whatever degree that I had the drive, desire, and discipline to pursue, but the means were there. I was well supported. I was deeply loved. I still am, I'm grateful to say, despite some of the things that I've done along the way. And to a large degree, I was sheltered from the worst of what we're capable of as human beings. So in practical terms, I grew up more equal. And that's just sort of the fact. Now, did the people that loved me and supported me and raised me, did they work hard so that could happen? Of course they did. And I'm so grateful that they did. However, when it comes to an idea like some are more equal than others, it also doesn't matter. Here's what I mean by that. The fact is that there are people everywhere that worked just as hard, loved just as deeply, in many cases gave everything that they had to protect and to provide, and they and their kids are still not treated as equals. And that differential is often understood to be okay. Not least of all by the same groups of people that would espouse the idea that, quote, all people are created by God as equals. And to me, this feels like a discrepancy that requires some further exploration. I'm going to reference the racialized world. You know what? Let me say that with more clarity. I'm going to reference the racist ideas I'm most familiar with to explore this further. As a Canadian cultural elite, I use the phrase advisedly as an identifier, I was and am aware that the racial group most commonly understood to be less equal than me was that of this continent's Indigenous people. I can only speculate, but I suspect that if I had grown up on the other side of the border, the same idea framework may well have resulted in my viewing Black people or other people of color in a similar way, equal but less so. How was this inequality, how was this racism justified or explained? Well, generally speaking, in one of two ways, and this is a familiar framework. We use this framework to wrestle with all kinds of tricky issues. And the simplest language we use for it is the language of nature versus nurture. And the nurture argument justifying this inequality essentially runs like this. We're all created equal, but some of us are inferior because we were born and bred in an inferior environment. Perhaps backward or even barbaric, culturally pathological, perennially mired in poverty, certainly broken in terms of home life, education, so on and so forth. In other words, our inferiority was nurtured. And if I'm inferior because I was nurtured in an inferior way, then those that know better can nurture that inferiority out of me. I can be made civilized, which means I can be made like the ones doing the so-called civilizing. In terms of European history, this idea goes all the way back to, you may have guessed it by now, the Greeks. We hold those people group responsible for a lot. In the Greek mind, those not like them were regarded as savages, scary, dangerous, inferior, and in need of having that nurtured out of them so that they could become civilized, you know, like a Greek. So that's explanation one, the nurture explanation. Explanation two is that those that are less equal are that way by nature. And that means that they are inferior genetically or biologically, by nature. And this is a state about which someone might say, without regarding it as dissonant, that, quote, It's not their fault. These conditions are understood to be permanent. You can't reform someone that has a lazy gene, or a stupid gene, or a dishonesty gene, or an intransigent genetic vulnerability to addiction, and so on. And at first glance, one of those explanations might seem a lot more palatable than the other. The nurture idea, which we could also call the assimilationist idea, has been the basis on which lots of well-intentioned folks have been part of things like civil rights movements and educational reform. Kind of easy to look backwards at some of those movements and see the good and not see the racist underpinnings of certain approaches to them. Here in Canada, for instance, it's this nurture slash assimilationist idea that can be understood as the general idea behind the residential schools. And we don't have to be avid historians to see how that turned out. The nature idea, which we could also call the segregationist idea, seems less likely to produce positive social change, but it's been presented as the positive idea behind things like medical treatments that are race-specific. The idea that it's something racially genetic that is behind statistics suggesting a greater degree of vulnerability to a disease or pathology. And in our contemporary world, these days, at this moment, we've seen this kind of logic used regarding the fact that greater numbers of some racialized groups are becoming infected with or dying of COVID-19. That's that same kind of thinking. And by the way, those studies that suggest, whether those are current studies or historic studies, that that medical things can be sort of assigned to a genetic inferiority or weakness, racially speaking, they don't hold up. As soon as you're aware of that bias and they're examined with that bias in mind, and so other variables are taken into account, it fairly quickly becomes clear that it's not actually genetics that are the key variable, but something environmental, something in diet, something in their surrounding environment that's creating a vulnerability. And the reason for that, genetically speaking, is quite simply that as human beings, we are so remarkably genetically similar that you can't actually create a significant variable based on race, the combination of race and genetics. It just doesn't hold up. Here's the bottom line. If I say that one group is inferior to another, it doesn't matter how I'm explaining it. I am expressing an oppressive idea. Even if I dress it up as reform, it's still vertical. It's still some are more equal than others. And if that verticality is understood in racial terms, that's racism. That's sort of the short version. Now, maybe you had the good fortune, maybe you had the privilege, maybe you had the just luck to grow up with some stories about humanity, perhaps even humanity and religion and race, that managed to circumvent all of that. If so, I would say be thankful and use your clearer understanding to make the world a place where equality becomes the norm. If that's not the case, and I'm willing to bet that for more than a few of us that is the fact, then we might need to ask, what could help us reconsider our story? One of the keys to growing in our ability to reconsider the way we look at the world is the recognition that making stories in order to explain what we're seeing and experiencing is a shared human inclination. This is one of those humans do this things. And as long as we have had the capacity to do so, humans have sought a connection with forces that are greater than our own. We see and we feel the mystery of the world around us. We marvel at how life makes more life. We are compelled, it seems, to make stories about it. And those drives and those desires to touch the infinite and to ponder the unknowable have often led our minds and hearts to make entire systems of belief. Complex, often deep and substantial explanations of our experiences of what is. Typically, the first set of stories that we make as a species when we're doing this kind of story making is stories about beginnings, about what often gets called creation. And these are kind of like, I don't know if you ever think about this, anybody who's sort of thought about the shape of film at all would be aware of this. These are sort of like the establishing shots at the beginning of a movie. They are the stories that say, this is the nature of the world that you're in. This is the nature of the world that you can see, and here's how it relates to the world that you can't see. And that's sort of the function of those stories. And often as not, we end up making religion on those stories, and our religions have brought us together as identifiable groups. Now, I'm gonna roar through an unfolding of a set of ideas here that actually has quite a bit running in the background. Excuse me, I'm not going to take the time to unpack it this morning, but just to outline it because I want to move past it as well. So when we take these origin stories, these establishing shot kinds of stories, and we make ways of thinking about them, we make religions about them, and those religions bring us together as identifiable groups. Inside those groups, typically there are teachers, there are holy people, there are prophets, there are leaders, whatever names we want to give them. There are sort of these prominent people. And what often happens is that those people in our religions put in place some ideas about how to live ethically and how to treat others. It's one of the things that religious founders or people whose ideas found religions often do. They often say, and here's how that works out. And those codes of ethics have often formed the basis for the ways that cultures and societies function, because religions, remember, bring us together as groups. And so these societies unfold out of these groups, and they unfold with these ideas about how to treat one another, which then kind of morph into ethical systems, which then get turned into laws. And that's often the way that sort of trajectory goes for what we think of now as just the laws of the land. If we trace them backwards, we'll see that shape. Religion can also provide opportunities for spiritual and emotional growth, and it can provide a network of people to support one another in all phases of our lives, and a powerful sense of belonging. And that sense of belonging is essential to our well-being and our thriving as humans. So it's very powerful stuff. So far, so good. You might say that sounds like the sorts of things we need, and if religion can help us have those things and experience those things, well, isn't that great? Now, toss in a dash of self-interest. If my ideas, if my story about the world can somehow become the prevailing story, I win. What's the prize? Well, initially, it might be something that we could call peace. It might be the reconciliation of the mind to the conditions of life. Look at that. The story that I'm telling myself about the nature of the world I'm in and how it works fits so great with all these questions, all these circumstances, all these things that I need to try to explain in order to experience peace, the conditions of life. And if my group becomes a preeminent one, we start to shape those conditions, not all of them, but many of them, and the story syncs with them even better then, because it's on the basis of that story and understanding that we are giving them shape. Chicken and egg. But that's one of the initial prizes, this sense of reconciliation of peace, and that is a profound and an empowering experience of feeling as though the story that we're telling ourselves answers the great questions that we have been asking ourselves. Very potent stuff. Following on that, if the religion is successful and it gains adherence, the prize is often access to a better life. More safety, more comfort, more power, more wealth. Short version, it's a leg up to a better place in society, access to a world in which it becomes easier to believe that some of us as humans are more equal than others. And then, to clinch the deal, we might make it an essential tenet of the religion to believe that whatever story it is that we're telling about the world is the truth, right? Revealed uniquely to us by God. And if we kind of make that a tenet of that religious system, now our ethics are God's way, our values are God's values, and our perspectives are God's truth. Now our story is superior. That means, among other things, that the other stories are inferior. And it's not that we can't be gracious about it. It's not that they don't have anything to offer, but in the end, they don't quite measure up. They're inferior. Now, it is not rocket science. How did it get to be rocket science? It's not rocket science to see how it follows that the people that generated the inferior stories must also be, in some ways that need to be explained, inferior peoples. Maybe all they really need is to learn the truth. Maybe that's what would save them from the wrong understandings that they have been nurtured in so that they can become our equals. I mean, truly our equals, as equal before God as we are. Or maybe they can't be saved because they're genetically incapable. Maybe they're irredeemable. I haven't been explicit about it, but I don't think it takes very much consideration to see how cultural entitlement and religious entitlement can become entangled. And it takes next to no imagination at all to see the incredible damage, the incendiary, even genocidal brand of racism that can be justified by the logic of my story is better than your story. Feel like we had a little inkling of this in the news cycle recently. This will not be everyone's perspective on this story, and I appreciate that, and I wish to respect that. I also don't want to try to duck something about which I think some critical thinking might be helpful. One of the things that was in that cycle was this news item about a group of churches wanting a free pass on the gathering regulations. And part of the logic, as it was presented to the government, is that the church operates under a different authority than the government. So a religious claim, a claim of a vertical claim that says the authority under which we operate is greater than the authority under which you operate. Therefore, we should not be subject to the laws of the land in this regard. That's an expression of that religious entitlement. Now, you can kind of get away with that when your prevailing story is also the prevailing cultural story. So, when religion and government are intertwined, so all the power of religion, which at certain points in history, Christian history, has been so enormous that we would refer to those periods of history as Christendom, the times in history when Christianity and government have been so intertwined as to be inseparable. You can kind of get away with that sort of entitlement, at least in terms of making up the rules and implementing them and reinforcing them. But in a post-Christian West, among other things, which is, I think, a fair way to describe Canada, a pluralist society, good luck, because that sense of we win and we get the privilege and power and entitlement that comes with being the elite. When that starts to change and we don't pay attention, we can say and do things that reveal our leftover entitlement. And that's how that story reads to me, as sort of an instance of the way cultural entitlement and religious entitlement can get intertwined. Now, in some ways, that's that outline that I just took us through, that's a narrative about broken religion, we could say. Religion misbehaving, religion being hurtful, not helpful, and so on. What's the alternative? Well, I know I do not have a master plan, but here's an idea to muse on and reflect on and consider the implications of. I think it's a potentially helpful first step to learn how not unique most of our stories are. That could sound like a way of sort of gutting those stories, of robbing them of their goodness in our lives. And that's not the way I experience this at all. I get how that could be the feeling, especially if we feel like we've kind of been buffered by or guarded by those stories, that our sense of privileged place has been protected by those stories. And so if we re-examine the stories, we could lose our place of privilege. That's true. And frankly, when you look around at the world today, losing our place of privilege, if that's how we're holding it, probably is something that needs to happen. Probably. That is something that needs to happen. So yes, I can appreciate how it would not feel like a pleasant exercise, but I think that seeing how our stories are not unique can, although it can be unpleasant and distressing even in those ways, it can also open into a new kind of freedom to take our stories to heart, to learn what is good there, and there will be something good there. In these metaphors we make about mystery, in these stories we tell ourselves, there is almost always something true and good. And that's not just true about one set of stories. That's just the nature of the stories we make. But we have to probe them with some humility and with some openness to get that. So it can be, you know, all of these things, right? Disconcerting, distressing, helpful, liberating. To put that idea more positively, maybe, to learn how much we share our questions about the unknown with other groups of humans and how much our stories that address those questions have in common with other human stories can be a remarkably empowering experience if what we wish for, if what we hope for, if what we long for, if what we are willing to work for is actually equality. Then it can do that. There's lots of material we could access to illustrate this, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to offer a couple of examples. And I'm going to work from the Judeo-Christian tradition because it's the one that the majority of the people in this community are most familiar with. There's other ways we could come at this. So all of these quotes, biblical quotes that I'm going to offer by way of comparison, are from Genesis, from the Hebrew creation stories, the Hebrew establishing shots that say this is the nature of the world in which we live and move and have our being. And it's on the basis of many of those stories that lots of Christian understandings of the world are built, paired with stories speaking to the same human questions, but drawn from other cultures. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take some of these Genesis story quotes and I'm going to sit them next to stories that other cultures have made up about the same questions, just by way of helping us perhaps begin to see how, in the same ways in which perhaps we could understand that we are genetically remarkably similar, to understand that in our great, great questions and our attempts to address those great questions with metaphors and stories and beliefs, we are also remarkably similar. So here we go, Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Some of you will recognize that quote. This quote is from the Song of the World, which is a legend of the indigenous Pima peoples of Arizona, who spoke to that same sense of what was before this, where did this all come from, in this way. In the beginning, there was only darkness everywhere, darkness and water. And the darkness gathered thick in places, crowding together and then separating, crowding and separating. Genesis. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And this is from the Hindu Upanishads, 8th century BCE. Quote, "In the beginning, there was only the great self reflected in the form of a person. Reflecting, it found nothing but itself. Then its first word was, 'This am I.'" From Genesis. "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work, which he had done." And if we go back to that Pima people group story, they rendered that exploration and idea this way. "I make the world, and lo, the world is finished. Thus I make the world, and lo, the world is finished." And we could continue at length in this regard. And if we did, we would find that there are, in those establishing stories in other cultures and other times, also several rather detailed stories from a variety of cultures that involve serpents and eating what you shouldn't, and how the knowledge that follows upon that independent exploration can make the world a more complex place, a less childlike place, and so on. Here's the point. It's not enough to just say, "I believe everyone is created equal." We've seen how easy it is to say we believe that and to still justify elitist, supremacist, or racist ideas and attitudes, and to turn those into laws and policies that oppress other people. You know, equal but not equal. But if we back up into the stories that we base those ideas on and see that they are shared human attempts to explain the mystery that we all share and our shared drive to connect to that mystery, then perhaps we can also begin to see that we are, in fact, all of equal value before God, to one another, in culture, in the marketplace, in our making and telling of stories and of religions. Everyone, everywhere, equal to one another. Peace, everybody. I hope that the balance of your day includes, if you are able, a chance to get outside and enjoy some of the relatively brief but sometimes staggeringly beautiful days that are Manitoba summer. And we'll see you again in this space next week. Also want to mention again how much I enjoy my communication with people during the week. This is very one way. This is very talking head. And when I'm looking at it, you know, on my phone as I'm speaking to you, the literalness of the talking head part is just inescapable. And so the interaction feels especially important and especially valuable. So please do feel free, as many of you have, and I hope more of you will, to call, to email, to text, to be in touch so we can communicate about your unique experiences and perspectives and things that are going on in your lives. All right? All right. Bye for now.